Egoism in Nietzsche and Rand by Stephen R.C. Hicks, published in the Journal of Ayn Rand Studies, Volume 10, Number 2, Spring of 2009, pages 249 to 291. Part 1 on Critiquing Altruism. Three Nietzsches and Ayn Rand. To what extent is Ayn Rand's ethical theory Nietzschean? Three Friedrich Nietzsches are relevant to making that judgment. Here is one Friedrich Nietzsche, the worshiper of human greatness. Quote, "The concept of greatness entails being noble, wanting to be by oneself, being able to be different, standing alone, and having to live independently." Unquote. "Such a man," quote, "has a taste only for what is good for him," unquote. And, quote, "instinctively seeks heavy responsibilities," unquote. Quote, "Every choice human being strives instinctively for a citadel and a secrecy where he is saved from the crowd, the many, the great majority," unquote. He also, quote, "knows how to make enemies everywhere," unquote. The noble man, quote, "honors himself as one who is powerful, also as one who has power over himself, who knows how to speak and be silent, who delights in being severe and hard with himself and respects all severity and hardness," unquote. There is, quote, "some fundamental certainty that a noble soul has about itself, something that cannot be sought, nor found, nor perhaps lost. The noble soul has reverence for itself," unquote. Plus, quote, "Believe me, the secret of the greatest fruitfulness and the greatest enjoyment of existence is to live dangerously. Build your cities under Vesuvius. Send your ships into uncharted seas," unquote. Living such a life, Nietzsche says, quote, "one emerges again and again into the light. One experiences again and again one's golden hour of victory. And then one stands forth as one was born, unbreakable, tensed, ready for new, even harder, remoter things, like a bow that distress serves to draw tauter," unquote. Here is another Friedrich Nietzsche, the critic of altruism, hypocrisy, and cowardice, and the best name-caller in the history of philosophy. Nietzsche calls Plato the philosopher who projects another realm of perfect and static forms in contrast to this messy and changeable physical world, quote, "a coward in the face of reality," unquote. Christianity, says Nietzsche, quote, "is Platonism for the people," that is to say, Plato for dummies, and also, quote, "a rebellion of everything that crawls on the ground against that which has height," unquote. Nietzsche calls Immanuel Kant, the ruling philosopher of Germany in the 19th century, quote, "that most deformed concept cripple of all time," unquote. And given Kant's, quote, "abhorrent scholasticism," unquote, that is, his predilection for spinning neutered, rationalistic webs of ideas to snare the unwary, a, quote, "disaster of a spider," unquote. The emerging welfare state of the 19th century is, quote, "the coldest of all cold monsters," where, quote, "the slow suicide of all is called life," unquote. Such quotations explain why Nietzsche's writings can be attractive to those also attracted to Ayn Rand's. Rand's sparkling prose and heroic view of man are, like Nietzsche's, a rush of adrenaline to intelligent young readers for whom the world is fresh and full of promise and whose whole lives are ahead of them. Her writings, like Nietzsche's, remain a powerful source of inspiration for older readers who have succeeded in remaining young at heart in a world that contains much compromise, complacency, disappointment, and outright evil. Nietzsche and Rand are kindred spirits of passion and exaltation. Those who stay with Rand philosophically as well as literarily do so because they judge that her philosophy of reason, independence, and freedom is true, and they hold on to those principles in the face of vigorous opposition from philosophers of irrationality, conformity, and authoritarianism. In most cases, Nietzsche's enemies are Rand's enemies, so philosophical readers of Rand resonate with Nietzsche when he attacks their common enemies in Plato, Kant, and the statists. Yet there is a third Nietzsche, one more ruthless and bloodthirsty. Speaking well of the noble races of the past, Nietzsche explains their accomplishments this way, quote, "One cannot fail to see at the bottom of all these noble races the beast of prey, the splendid blonde beast prowling about avidly in search of spoil and victory. This hidden core needs to erupt from time to time. The animal has to get out again and go back to the wilderness," unquote. About slavery, Nietzsche says that a healthy aristocracy, quote, "accepts with a good conscience the sacrifice of untold human beings who, for its sake, must be reduced and lowered to incomplete human beings, to slaves, to instruments," unquote. About war, Nietzsche says, quote, "One must learn from war. One must learn to sacrifice many and to take one's cause seriously enough not to spare men," unquote. About violence in general, Nietzsche says approvingly, quote, "The beginnings of everything great on earth are soaked in blood thoroughly and for a long time," unquote. Remarks such as these should give pause to any identification of Rand's views with Nietzsche's, given Rand's vehement opposition to slavery and the zero-sum conflict view of the world. Nietzsche has become part of the philosophical canon, and Rand is becoming so. Commonly, the two are identified, and this is why the issue of the intellectual relationship between Friedrich Nietzsche and Ayn Rand is an important one. Nietzsche is usually interpreted as an arch-individualist, as anti-altruistic, and as an iconoclast outside the mainstream. The same points are true of Rand. So to many casual readers, a simple identification of Nietzsche and Rand follows. Some intellectuals on Nietzsche and Rand. A sampling of popular intellectual culture yields many such identifications. Norman Markowitz, 2005, a leftist critic, speaks of, quote, "Ragnar Sig Danishuld, a character in Ayn Rand's campy glorification of social Darwinism and laissez-faire capitalism." Atlas shrugged. Rand called her jivey mishmash of Herbert Spencer and Friedrich Nietzsche objectivism, meaning that a social law of the jungle represents the highest level of science, unquote. Philosophy blogger Mario, 2003, connects Nietzsche and Rand this way, quote, "Nietzsche is explicitly on the side of the aristocracy, another admirer of Napoleon, and he is unashamedly opposed to democracy and Buddhism, which he equates with nihilism. In these latter choices, he foreshadows Aldous Huxley's Brave New World and the novels of Ayn Rand," unquote. Science fiction writer China Miéville in 2002 is less flattering in evaluating Rand's writings. Quote, "This panoply of portentous Nietzscheanism light," unquote. Colin Barth in 2004 as a negative moral evaluation to the charge of Rand's being an intellectual lightweight. Quote, "It was impossible to liken Rand to Nietzsche, but only because Rand was a child in comparison, though not in innocence or playfulness," unquote. And Abiola Lapite in 2005 concludes that Rand's continuing appeal can only be explained in terms of juvenile psychology. Quote, "The Nietzsche-aping, pulp-fiction-writing, self-promoting egotist who is still worshipped by millions of callow teenagers and Peter Pans worldwide," unquote. None of the above quotations are from professional philosophers, but they are from intelligent journalists, graduate students in philosophy, and political commentators, and they speak to a reputation common to Nietzsche and Rand. Most academics will say much the same thing. Quote, "Most philosophy professors will tell you that Ayn Rand is a poor man's Nietzsche," unquote. Lee, 2004. The late Alan Bloom, 1987, is representative. Quote, "When I first noticed the decline of reading during the late 60s, I began asking my large introductory classes and any other group of younger students to which I spoke, what books really count for them? There's always a girl who mentions Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead, a book, though hardly literature, which, with its sub-Nietzschean assertiveness, excites somewhat eccentric youngsters to a new way of life," unquote. There is another parallel between Nietzsche and Rand in the judgments made by both about philosophers who were their contemporaries. When Nietzsche was a young professor of classical philology at the University of Basel in Switzerland, the university's professors of philosophy told their students not to take Nietzsche's courses, arguing that he was an intellectual lightweight and not really a philosopher. Quote, "For a time, Nietzsche, then professor of classical philology at the University of Basel, had no students in his field. His lectures were sabotaged by German philosophy professors who advised their students not to show up for Nietzsche's courses." Cowan, 1962, page 4. The above quotations illustrate two variations on a common theme of believing Nietzsche's and Rand's views to be essentially similar. One, the first is that Nietzsche and Rand are equivalent in the content of their philosophies. But whereas Nietzsche is now respected for the philosophical power of his views, Rand can be dismissed as an intellectual lightweight. Two, the second is that Rand's views echo Nietzsche's, but in a cruder, more callous, uncaring, and bloodthirsty way. In my judgment, the theme common to both one and two is false. Nietzsche and Rand disagree on many, many more philosophical issues than they agree upon, even focusing on their ethical theories, where the common assumption is that their views are quite close, they agree on very little. They share a deep agreement that altruism is an immoral and dangerous ethic, and their analyses and condemnations of altruism are strikingly similar. But when one turns to their positive alternatives to altruism, one finds an almost complete opposition. The issue of the intellectual relationship between Nietzsche and Rand is important, both for understanding each thinker's views accurately in their own right, and for understanding where each stands in the landscape of philosophical possibilities. Nietzsche, for example, was an influence on Sigmund Freud, Martin Heidegger, Martin Buber, most of the intellectuals and politicians associated with the National Socialists, and most of the postmodernists, including Michel Foucault and Jacques Derrida. All of those thinkers' views are distant from Rand's. And while Nietzsche was also an influence upon Rand, to call all of them Nietzschean is not clarifying. Most of those thinkers were steeped in the European continental intellectual tradition, so in my judgment, the connections between Nietzsche's and their views are much stronger. One problem that has plagued scholarship on Nietzsche is the many interpreters who come to Nietzsche from the Anglo-American tradition and read him through the lens of that tradition's Enlightenment individualism. Yet Nietzsche warns against such readings and repeatedly has only contempt for the English style of doing philosophy. Quote, "They are no philosophical race, these Englishmen. Bacon signifies an attack on the philosophical spirit. Hobbes, Hume, and Locke a debasement and lowering of the value of the concept of philosophy for more than a century. It was against Hume that Kant arose and rose. It was Locke of whom Schelling said, understandably, je méprise Locke, I despise Locke. In their fight against the English mechanistic doltification of the world, Hegel and Schopenhauer were of one mind with Goethe, those two hostile brother geniuses in philosophy who strove apart toward opposite poles of the German spirit and in the process wronged each other as only brothers wrong each other." Unquote. That's from Beyond Good and Evil, section 252. In other cases, however, the association of Nietzsche with Rand is based on ignorance or a superficial reading of one or both, or upon a desire to package deal Rand with Nietzsche in order to tar her with the unsavory elements of Nietzsche's philosophy. So the issue is worth a closer look. A caveat. In this essay, I will be focusing only upon Nietzsche's and Rand's ethical philosophies, and only upon Rand's mature ethical philosophy. I will leave aside for other scholarship their views on metaphysics, epistemology, politics, and art, as well as the issue of how Nietzschean or not Rand's youthful writings were. Egoism, altruism, and selfishness. The normative content of an ethics follows from its standard of value. What should be one's highest value, the value to which one dedicates one's efforts and against which one measures all other values? The two major contenders in the history of ethics are self and others. Ethics of self-interest hold that one's own self is one's highest value, that one should pursue one's self-interest, and that one should measure all other values in terms of their impact on one's self-interest. All such ethical theories are egoist, from the Greek ego for self or I. Egoism is thus a principled self-ism. Ethics that reject self-interest as the highest value usually substitute the interests of others as the highest value and hold that one should dedicate oneself primarily to the interests of others and measure all other values in terms of their impact on the interests of others. All such theories are altruist, from the Latin alter for other. Altruism is thus a principled otherism. A series of closely related questions must be answered in determining the full content of an ethical theory, whether egoist or altruist. What is the self? Is the self to be identified with one's mind, body, spirit, reason, or emotions? Is the self essentially individual or not? Does the self have the capacity of volition or not? And if so, how much power does the self have to shape itself? What are the self's major interests? Are they the satisfaction of basic physical needs, pleasure, a sense of community, serenity, freedom, knowledge, power, wealth, flourishing, or what? Are those interests intrinsic, objective, or subjective? Are they universal to the species, or are they particular to the individual? By what cognitive means does the self come to know its interests? Through instinct, passion, reason, or what? Is self-interest the standard of value? Is ethics fundamentally about the maintenance and development of oneself, or is the self primarily a means to or part of the development of some value beyond itself? Or is the self valueless, as some religions hold, or a disvalue, as some environmentalists hold? What specific policies of thought and action should the self practice? Should one be rational or passionate, productive or predatory or charitable, proactive or passive, proud or humble, benevolent or aggressive, or what? Not at the outset to assume that the above are either-or choices. As a result of the above, are self-interests mutually satisfiable socially? Does the pursuit of one's self-interest conflict with others? Or does it leave others unaffected? Or is there a harmony? Integrated sets of answers to the above questions fall into three major categories: what I will call egoism, altruism, and colloquial selfishness. For example, suppose that one holds wealth to be one of the self's interests. Selfishness, in much common usage, is the position that one should intentionally pursue one's self-interest, in this case, the acquisition of wealth, but that one person's pursuit of wealth conflicts with others' pursuit of wealth, so one should be aggressive against others to get wealth. One major form of altruism holds that the pursuit of wealth is in conflict with a higher value, other people's peace and stability, so one should sacrificially restrain one's interest in wealth for the sake of others. Another form holds that others' need for basic wealth is in conflict with one's desire for luxuries, so one should in principle sacrifice luxuries and act charitably. Egoism is the position that wealth is a value that must be produced, so one should commit to producing the wealth one needs. Yet one's being productive is also beneficial to others, given that production creates value for mutually beneficial trade. Generalizing from wealth as an example to policy for all of life's values, selfishness holds that one should intentionally pursue one's self-interest at the expense of others. Altruism holds that one should intentionally, selflessly pursue others' interests at one's own expense. And egoism holds that one should intentionally pursue one's self-interest, which has as a consequence the possibility of mutually beneficial transactions with others. Egoism and selfishness agree on the moral intent, seek one's self-interest, but not about the necessary means and consequences of moral action. Selfishness and altruism agree that self-interests are in zero-sum conflict, but not about whose interests should be rated highest. The connection to Nietzsche and Rand is this. Both agree that altruism is bad, and Rand learned a great deal from Nietzsche. But when one turns to their positive ethical theories, one finds an almost complete opposition. Nietzsche and Rand disagree about what the self is, what its major interests are, whether self-interests are mutually satisfiable socially, what major policies of action are moral, and even whether self-interest is the highest moral value. A Nietzschean sketch. God is dead. For thousands of years, humans have been religious, but in the modern world, religion has become a shadow of its former self. Nietzsche's dramatic phrase, "God is dead," is meant to capture the personal and shocking quality of this revelation. For those raised religiously, religion personalized the world. It gave them a sense that the world had a purpose and that they were a part of a larger plan. It gave them the comfort that despite appearances, we are all equal and cared for, and that upon death, instead of a cold grave, a possible happily ever after ending awaits us. But in the modern world, we find it hard to believe that anymore. We have seen the dramatic rise of science, which has offered less comfortable answers to questions religion traditionally had a monopoly on. We have thrown off the shackles of feudalism with its unquestioning acceptance of authority and knowing our place. We are more individualistic and naturalistic in our thinking. But in historical time, all of this has happened very quickly, in the span of a few centuries. For millennia, we have been religious. But come the 19th century, even the average man has heard that religion may have reached the end of its journey. For most of us, even the suggestion of this hints at a crisis. Imagine a 13-year-old who is awakened in the middle of the night to be told by strangers that both his parents have died. He is suddenly an orphan. As long as he can remember, his mother and father have been presences in his life, looking after him, guiding him, sometimes firmly, but always a benevolent protection and support in a world that he is not yet able to handle on his own. Now they are gone, and ready or not, he is thrust into that world alone. How does the young teen handle that sudden transition? Culturally, Nietzsche says, we are like that young teen. For as long as we can remember, our society has relied upon God the Father to look after us, to be a benevolent and sometimes stern guiding force through a difficult world. But now suddenly we are orphaned. We wake up one morning to discover in our heart of hearts that our naively childhood religious beliefs have withered. So now, whether we like it or not, a question creeps into our minds. How do we face the prospect of a world without God and religion? In the 19th century, says Nietzsche, most people do not face that question well. Nihilism's symptoms. Most people avoid the issue, sensing that even to raise it would be to enter dangerous territory. They sense that the game might be up for religion, but out of fear, they shut off their minds and will themselves to believe that God is still out there somewhere. Life without religion is too scary to contemplate, so they retreat to a safety zone of belief and repeat nervously the formulas they have learned about faith. Now, says Nietzsche, it is one thing for a medieval peasant to have a simple-minded faith, but for us moderns, such a faith has a tinge of dishonesty about it. Slightly better to Nietzsche, but not much, are the socialists of the 19th century. Socialism is on the rise, and many socialists have abandoned the religion of their youth, but only halfway. Most socialists accept that God is dead, but then they are very concerned that the state take God's place and look after them. The mighty state will provide for us and tell us what to do and protect us against the mean people of the world. Think of it this way. The Judeo-Christian tradition says that this is a world of sin, right, in which the weak suffer at the hands of the strong, that we should all be selfless and serve God and others, especially the sick and the helpless, and that in a future ideal world, heaven, the lion will lie down with the lamb, and the inescapable power of God will bring salvation to the meek and judgment to the wicked. The socialist tradition says this is a world of evil exploitation in which the strong take advantage of the weak. But we should all be selfless and sacrifice for the good of others, especially the needy, from each according to his ability to each according to his need. And the forces of history will necessarily bring about a future ideal world that will end all harsh competition, empowering the oppressed and eliminating the evil exploiters. Both religion and socialism thus glorify weakness and need. Both recoil from the world as it is, tough, unequal, harsh. Both flee to an imaginary future realm where they can feel safe. Both say, be a nice boy, be a good little girl, share, feel sorry for the little people, and both desperately seek someone to look after them, whether it be God or the state. So where, asks Nietzsche, are the men of courage? Who is willing to stare into the abyss? Who can stand alone on the icy mountaintop? Who can look a tiger in the eye without flinching? Such men exist. Every generation produces its occasional magnificent men, sparkling, vital men who accept easily that life is tough, unequal, unfair, and who welcome asserting their strength to meet the challenge. Those who have unbending wills against anything the world can throw at them. But such magnificent men seem to be few and far between in the 19th century, and Nietzsche wonders why. And he looks back on past cultures where the magnificent men dominated. Strength was prized, and inequality was a fact of life. Assertiveness and conquest were a source of pride. He names the Japanese feudal nobility as an example, with their samurai code of honor, the Indian Brahmins who rose and imposed their caste system, the Vikings who raided ruthlessly up and down the European coast, the expansionist Arabs, and of course, the awesome Roman Empire. What explains this stark contrast? Why do some cultures rise to greatness and unabashedly impose their will upon the world, while other cultures seem apologetic and urge upon us a bland conformity? Two biopsychological types. Part of the answer, says Nietzsche, is biological. All of organic nature is divided into two types of species, those who are naturally herd animals and those who are naturally loners, those who are prey and those who are predators. Some animals are by nature sheep, field mice, or cows, and some animals are by nature wolves, hawks, or lions. Psychologically and physically, this divide also runs right through the human species. Some people are born fearful and inclined to join a herd, and some are born fearless and inclined to seek lonely heights. Some of us are born sedentary and sluggish, and some of us are born crackling with purpose and craving adventure. Some of us, to use Nietzsche's language, are born to be masters, and some are born slaves. There is a continuum here, but one cannot do anything about which type one essentially is. There's a brute biological fact here. Our traits are evolutionarily bred into us. Just as a sheep cannot help but be sheepish, and a hawk cannot help but be hawkish, each of us inherits from our parents a long line of inbuilt traits. Quote, "It cannot be effaced from a man's soul what his ancestors have preferably and most constantly done." Unquote. Biological determinism is for Nietzsche a consequence of a more general metaphysical determinism. Quote, "The single human being is a piece of fatum from the front and from the rear, one law more, one necessity more for all that is yet to come and to be. To say to him, 'Change yourself,' is to demand that everything be changed, even retroactively." Unquote. The master types live by strength, creativity, independence, assertiveness, and related traits. They respect power, courage, boldness, risk-taking, even recklessness. It is natural for them to follow their own path no matter what, to rebel against social pressure and conformity. And by contrast, the slave types live in conformity. They tend to passivity, dependence, meekness. It is natural for them to stick together for a sense of security, as herd animals do. Psychology and morality. Nietzsche then turns to morality, good and bad, right and wrong. For a long time, we have been taught that morality is a matter of commandments set in stone thousands of years ago. Not so, says Nietzsche. What we take to be moral depends on our biological nature, and different biological natures dictate different moral codes. Think of it this way. If you're a sheep, then what will seem good to you as a sheep? Being able to graze peacefully, sticking close together with others just like you, being part of the herd and not straying off. What will seem bad to you? Wolves will seem bad, and anything wolf-like, predatory, or aggressive. But what if you are a wolf? Then strength, viciousness, and contempt for the sheep will come naturally to you and seem good. There is nothing the wolves and the sheep can agree on morally. Their natures are different, as are their needs and goals, as is what feels good to them. Of course, it would be good for the sheep if they could convince the wolves to be more sheep-like, but no self-respecting wolf will fall for that. as Nietzsche puts it amusingly, quote, "That lambs dislike great birds of prey does not seem strange. Only it gives no grounds for reproaching those birds of prey for bearing off little lambs. And if the lambs say among themselves, these birds of prey are evil, and whoever is least like a bird of prey, but rather its opposite, a lamb, would he not be good? There is no reason to find fault with this institution of an ideal, except perhaps that the birds of prey might view it a little ironically and say, we don't dislike them at all, these good little lambs. We even love them. Nothing is more tasty than a tender lamb." Unquote. Nietzsche argues that the same holds for humans. The divide between strong and weak, assertive and timid, runs right through the human species. Consequently, the right question to ask about morality is not, is such and such a value really valuable? But rather, what kind of person finds this value valuable? One's moral code, Nietzsche holds, is a, quote, decisive witness to who he is, unquote, to the, quote, innermost drives of his nature, unquote. Quote, moral judgments, Nietzsche says, are symptoms and sign languages which betray the process of physiological prosperity or failure, unquote. Genealogy. So, one's moral code is a function of one's psychological makeup, and one's psychological makeup is a function of one's biological makeup. The biological language and examples show that biology is crucial to Nietzsche's views on morality. Nietzsche was a precocious 15 years old when Charles Darwin's Origin of Species was published in 1859. Much of the intellectual world was moving away from thinking of the world in terms of timeless absolutes to viewing it in terms of process and change, and Nietzsche is among the first to apply evolutionary concepts to morality. Moral codes are part of a biological type's life strategy of survival, and the more one looks at the history of morality evolutionarily and biologically, the more one is struck by the dramatic changes in moral codes across time. And this is the key problem, Nietzsche argues, when we consider the altruist and egoist moral codes, for the historical records shows a disturbing inversion. Formerly, we prized above all excellence and power, and we looked down upon the humble and the lowly. Yet now the meek, the humble, and the common man are the, quote, good, unquote, while the aggressive, the powerful, the strong, the proud are, quote, evil, unquote. Somehow, the morality of the weak has become dominant, and the morality of the strong has declined. This moral inversion is dangerous. The traits of strength and power, that is, those that ennoble man, are now condemned, and the traits of ordinariness and modesty, that is, those that weaken man, are praised. Morality, accordingly, has become a bad thing, or, more paradoxically, morality has become immoral, as Nietzsche puts it, quote, so that precisely morality would be to blame if the highest power and splendor actually possible to the type man was never in fact attained, so that precisely morality was the danger of dangers? Unquote. Accordingly, Nietzsche argues, quote, we need a critique of moral values. The value of these values themselves must first be called into question, and for that there is needed a knowledge of the conditions and circumstances in which they grew, under which they evolved and changed, unquote. The morality of the weak has somehow become dominant, and the morality of the strong has declined. How is this rather paradoxical state of affairs to be explained? Part of the story is biopsychological, in terms of what morality resonates with what psychological type of person one is. But part of the story is cultural, and here there is a history lesson. Quote, under what conditions did man devise these value judgments, good and evil, and what value do they themselves possess? Unquote. Different moral codes develop under different moral circumstances, so Nietzsche searches history for the survival circumstances that enabled and necessitated the development of the altruistic slave code. In the West, Nietzsche finds the slave morality's roots in the Judeo-Christian tradition, in a decisive set of events that occurred early in Jewish history before the time of Moses, the enslavement of the Jews in Egypt. The significant result of the Jews being enslaved for a long time was the development and internalization of a moral code suitable for surviving slavery. Suppose that you are a slave. How do you survive? By contrast, what actions will kill you? What actions will increase your chances of staying alive? And if you have children who are born into slavery, what survival strategies will you teach them? In order to survive, a slave must obey the master. This does not come naturally. So the first lesson is, you must stifle your nature. Suppose the master strikes you. The desire for revenge comes naturally, but you have to stifle it. Suppose the master tells you to wait. Being inactive does not come naturally, but you must suppress your desire for activity. Suppose the master tells you to do something you do not want to do. You must override your desire to do what you want and obey. Generalizing, you must train yourself to restrain your natural impulses and to internalize a humble, patient, obedient self. You know you must do this because slaves who do not end up dead. Consequently, Nietzsche asserts, slave virtues have survival value. Obedience, humility, forgiveness, and patience are good for slaves. And those are the traits slaves will drill into their children if they want them to survive. Over time, the slave virtues become cultural values. Thus, Nietzsche argues, the slave values became the internalized cultural values of the Jews and were precisely what enabled them to survive their long enslavement. In every generation, many people are sheep-like and do not especially mind being slaves. But others resent it, and here the story Nietzsche tells becomes darker. Some of those slaves are living human beings with a human being's desire to live, grow, express who one is. All humans have the will to power. But what if they cannot express it? Then they must live in constant frustration. In order to survive, they must direct their natural strength and assertiveness against the expression of their own strength and assertiveness. This naturally leads them to resent the master strongly. But they also start to hate themselves for doing what the master says, and for their own role in suppressing themselves. But psychologically, hating oneself causes unbearable pressure inside. Quote, the outward discharge of the instincts was inhibited and turned backward against man himself. Hostility, cruelty, joy in persecuting, in attacking, in change, in destruction, all this turned against the possessors of such instinct. That is the origin of the bad conscience. Unquote. Hatred of the strong, self-hatred, internal torment, and revenge fantasies to ease the pain become the lived psychological reality of such slaves. Make this psychological reality a matter of months and years, and the results will be very ugly and poisonous. More provocatively, Nietzsche argues that such slave individuals who feel the internal war most strongly become the social leaders of the slaves. That is to say, they become their priests. The priests are those individuals among the slaves who prove to have the most drive, however thwarted, and the most cunning. Quote, it is because of their impotence that in them hatred grows to monstrous and uncanny proportions. The truly great haters in world history have always been priests. Unquote. In their leadership role, it is the priests who most strongly advocate meekness, humility, and obedience to their flock, and who condemn the aggressive strength and pride of the masters. The priests are not in a position to use physical power against the masters, and the physically powerful masters find it beneath their dignity to fight against an unarmed and to them contemptible enemy. Instead, the priests develop and use morality as their weapon of confrontation. The morality that enables their survival as weak slaves is also useful as a weapon against the strong master. Praising the meek and condemning the strong is both a strengthening tool for the weak and a weakening tool against the strong. Made into an explicit code, Judeo-Christian ethics, quote, has waged a war to the death against this higher type of person. It has banned the basic instincts of this type, unquote. To keep this sketch sketchy, Nietzsche holds that Christianity is a strategy within Judaism and part of its long-range strategy. The decisive battle is not between Jews and Christians, but between the slavish morality common to both Jews and Christians, and the master morality of those capable of living a fully human life. The Judeo-Christian moral code becomes part of their revenge strategy. Its point is to enable the weaker to survive in a harsh world in which they are often on the receiving end of the big stick, but also to undermine the master type's confidence in themselves, and eventually to subdue and bring down the masters so as to exact a spiritual revenge. As evidence, Nietzsche paraphrases standard Judeo-Christian rhetoric about how their kingdom shall come one day, and God will then visit his wrath upon the rich and powerful. In a perfect catch, he quotes St. Thomas Aquinas, quote, "In order that the bliss of the saints be more delightful for them, and that they may render more copious thanks to God for it, it is given to them to see perfectly the punishment of the damned." Unquote. So we have Nietzsche's views on the morality of altruism. It is a twofold strategy of slave types. One, a survival code for the weak, and two, as revenge and a power play against the strong. Historically, in Nietzsche's judgment, there is no question who is winning the age-old battle between the weak and the strong. He takes Tertullian's question, "What has Athens to do with Jerusalem?" and substitutes Rome for Athens, Rome being the greatest empire of classical times, Rome's values thus being the antipode of Jerusalem's. As evidence of whether Rome or Judea is winning, he invites us to consider to whom we kneel down before in Rome today. In the 19th century, quote, "Everything is visibly becoming Judaized, Christianized, mobized," unquote, and the chief slave, that is, the Pope, has for a long time established his camp and planted his flag in the center of what was the greatest master empire the world had ever seen. So for Nietzsche, the modern world is in a moral crisis. The code of the slaves, that is, altruism, is ascendant, and the moral code of the masters is in decline. The master code is the one that will best enable and foster human development. Yet virtually everyone either believes altruism, pays lip service to it, or feels guilty about not living it. Comparing Nietzsche's and Rand's critiques of altruism. For purposes of comparison of Nietzsche and Rand, let us distinguish five varieties of altruism in increasing orders of destructiveness. 1. Altruism as a policy of collectivism for the purpose of mutual self-support. 2. Altruism as a tactic of the weak to protect themselves against the strong. 3. Altruism as a tactic of the weak to get support from the strong. 4. Altruism as a strategy of the weak to get power over the strong in order to rule them. And 5. Altruism as a strategy by the weak to destroy the strong out of envy, hatred, or revenge. Nietzsche and Rand both recognize type 1 altruism. History provides many examples of monastic and religious communities that isolate themselves and live communally. The key organizing concepts of such communities are collective assets, solidarity, and conformity. Both Nietzsche and Rand also recognize type 2 altruism. Nietzsche regularly invokes herd animal metaphors and examples to illustrate the instinctual or strategic practice of seeking safety in numbers against a qualitatively superior enemy. Quote, "All the sick and sickly instinctively stride after a herd organization as a means of shaking off their dull displeasure and feeling of weakness. The ascetic priest divines this and furthers it." Unquote. Rand illustrates type 2 in The Fountainhead, in the official philosophy Ellsworth Toohey uses when preaching to the masses, for example, in his speech to the strikers of the Building Trades Union. The key concepts in Toohey's speech are unity, the aggression of the owners, and the consequent role of the unions as a self-protection agency to fight back. Type 3 altruism appears in Nietzsche's writings as a danger to the strong. The weak and the poor use altruistic morality as a tool to make the stronger serve them. That is a danger to the strong, Nietzsche argues, because it will sidetrack them from their proper self-development. Quote, "The sick represent the greatest danger for the healthy. It is not the strongest, but the weakest who spell disaster for the strong, unquote. Nietzsche's reason for this is that, quote, what is to be feared, what has a more calamitous effect than any other calamity, is that man should inspire not profound fear, but profound nausea, also not great fear, but great pity, unquote. Pity then leads the strong to feel obligations of charity, compassion, and to devote themselves to succor. A parallel version of type 3 altruism appears in Rand's Atlas Shrugged, in the case of the strategy that Reardon's mother and brother pursue to ensure that he will continue to support them. They speak the language of obligation, pity, and compassion, and despite his inarticulate reservations and inchoate feelings of ickiness, Reardon accepts their implied demands on the terms they present. Type 4 altruism is the altruism of power lust. Nietzsche holds that all living beings embody and are driven by a will to power, but that the strategies pursued by the weaker must necessarily be more cunning. Quote, the will of the weak to represent some form of superiority, their instinct for devious paths to tyranny over the healthy, where can it not be discovered, this will to power of the weakest? Unquote. But unable to compete by means of physical vitality and vigor, the weak must employ psychological weapons. Quote, the moral judgment, unquote, is the means by which the, quote, weak and mediocre weaken and pull down the stronger, unquote. Type 4 altruism is also prominent in both of Rand's major novels. One subplot of The Fountainhead is the battle between Gail Winand and Toohey. Winand pursues the traditional master power strategy of physical wealth, including the physical intimidation of his business competitors and the benefits wealth can bring. Toohey's strategy is more subtle and sneaky psychological route to power. A rare moment of self-revelation occurs late in the novel when Toohey explains his philosophy to a broken Peter Keating. Quote, it is only a matter of discovering the lever. If you learn how to rule one single man's soul, you can get the rest of mankind. It's the soul, Peter, the soul. Not whips, or swords, or fire, or guns. That's why the Caesars, the Attilas, the Napoleons were fools and did not last. We will. The soul, Peter, is that which cannot be ruled. It must be broken. Unquote. Toohey's particular tactics to achieve the strategy are ones Nietzsche had outlined. Use the slave morality to make the strong, quote, sick, miserable, malevolent against himself, full of hatred against the springs of life, full of suspicion against all that was still strong and happy, unquote. Toohey elaborates in detail, quote, there are many ways. Here's one. Make man feel small. Make him feel guilty. Kill his aspiration and his integrity. Preach selflessness. Tell man that he must live for others. Tell man that altruism is the ideal. Not a single one of them has ever achieved it, and not a single one ever will. His every living instinct screams against it. But don't you see what you accomplish? Man realizes that he is incapable of what he's accepted as the noblest virtue, and it gives him a sense of guilt, of sin, of his own basic unworthiness. Unquote. Guilty individuals are weakened and much easier to manipulate and rule. Early in Atlas, Rand introduces type 4 altruism in the exchange between Reardon and Francisco at Reardon's anniversary party, where Francisco attempts to warn Reardon of the real battle he is fighting. Reardon responds dismissively, quote, a battle? What battle? I hold the whip hand. I don't fight the disarmed, unquote. Francisco replies, quote, are they? They have a weapon against you. It is their only weapon, but it's a terrible one. Ask yourself what it is sometime, unquote. Type 5 altruism is the most disturbing and terminal case of altruism, and both Nietzsche and Rand see it operative in many individuals and movements. Type 4 altruism is about achieving power in order to rule, yet the desire to rule is still a positive goal. Type 5 is about getting power as a means purely to destroy the good and the great. It is this type of altruism, because of its utter malevolence, that gives pause to many thoughtful and well-meaning interpreters of Nietzsche and Rand, and leads them to wonder whether Nietzsche and Rand exaggerate their enemies' positions. Nietzsche is explicit. Quote,
Moral judgments and condemnations constitute the favorite revenge of the spiritually limited against those less limited, unquote. Emphasis added. And in its extreme form, the rage of the weak and impotent erupts into nihilism. Quote, when some men fail to accomplish what they desire to do, they exclaim angrily, "May the whole world perish!" This repulsive emotion is the pinnacle of envy, whose implication is, if I cannot have something, no one can have anything. No one is to be anything. Unquote. To bring the strong down to their level, he argues, the weak use the language of the altruistic ethic. Quote, when would they achieve the ultimate, subtlest, sublimest triumph of revenge? Undoubtedly, if they succeeded in poisoning the consciences of the fortunate with their own misery, with all misery, so that one day the fortunate began to be ashamed of their good fortune, and perhaps said to one another, it is disgraceful to be fortunate, there is too much misery, unquote. The goal is not to use pain and misery to induce the strong to help solve the problems of those in pain and misery. The goal is to inflict the same pain and misery on the strong. That is revenge, to subject one's enemy to the same torments.
In religious uses of the altruistic ethic on this Nietzschean interpretation, the purpose of heaven and hell is not a relatively benevolent two-pronged strategy of inspiring goodness by the carrot of heaven and the stick of hell. Rather, the purpose is to send one's enemies to hell. Here again, Nietzsche's quoting St. Thomas Aquinas is relevant. In order that the bliss of the saints may be more delightful for them, and that they may render more copious thanks to God for it, it is given to them to see perfectly the punishment of the damned. Unquote. In Atlas, Rand provides many examples of type 5 altruism. Lillian Reardon's treatment of Hank is not a misguided attempt to get attention or to repair a failing marriage. It is a constant attack on Reardon's identity and worth. The same is true of James Taggart's treatment of his wife, Cheryl. His goal is to destroy her, quote, childish and naive, unquote, belief in the nobility of man. Taggart's strategy was only semi-explicit to himself during most of Atlas, but Rand has Taggart realize its full import consciously toward the end of Atlas during the torture of John Galt. Knowing that further torturing Galt will kill him, thus destroying Galt's ability to help them, Taggart exclaims, quote, I don't care. I want to break him. I want to hear him scream. I want, unquote. Rand, the narrator, goes on to explain Taggart's nihilistic self-revelation. Quote, it was not his incommunicable soul or his love for others or his social duty or any of the fraudulent sounds by which he had maimed his self-esteem. It was the lust to destroy whatever was living, unquote. This sub-theme in Atlas is continuous with Rand's earlier novel, The Fountainhead. Toohey explains further to Keating the real strategic purpose behind his various power tactics of communal organizing, his critique of individual creativity, the promotion of mediocrity such as Keating, and so on. Keating asks whinily, what do you want? Toohey snaps, Howard Roark's neck. Toohey then elaborates, quote, I don't want to kill him. I want him in jail. You understand? In jail. In a cell. Behind bars. Locked, stopped, strapped, and alive. Unquote. Toohey is not seeking any positive value, only the destruction of an excellent human being. Toohey is a fictional character, of course, but it is worth remembering Nietzsche's non-fictional quoting of Aquinas, as above, and that Aquinas is in good company, so to speak. 9 centuries earlier, St. Augustine, in The Saint's Knowledge of the Punishment of the Wicked, had included the spectacle of hell as one of the viewing pleasures for those in heaven. Quote, the good go out to see the punishment of the wicked, so as to witness the torments of the wicked in their bodily presence. Unquote. 2 centuries earlier, Church Father Tertullian had exulted over the destruction of the world and the torment of kings, philosophers, poets, and athletes in hell. Quote, that last day of judgment with its everlasting issues, that day unlooked for by the nations, the theme of their derision when the world hoary with age and with all its many products shall be consumed in one great flame. How vast a spectacle then bursts upon the eye! What there excites my admiration?
what my derision? What sight gives me joy? What rouses me to exultation as I see so many illustrious monarchs whose reception into the heavens was publicly announced, groaning now in the lowest darkness with great Jove himself? And those too who bore witness of their exaltation, governors of provinces too, who persecuted the Christian name, in fires more fierce than those which in their days of pride they raged against the followers of Christ. What world's wise men besides, the very philosophers, in fact, who taught their followers that God had no concern in aught that is sublunary, and were wont to assure them that either they had no souls, or that they would never return to the bodies which at death they had left, now covered with shame before the poor deluded ones as one fire consumes them. Poets also, trembling not before the judgment seat of Rhadamanthus or Minos, but of the unexpected Christ. I shall have a better opportunity then of hearing the tragedians, louder voiced in their own calamity, of viewing the play-actors much more dissolute in the dissolving flame, of looking upon the charioteer all glowing in his chariot of fire, of beholding the wrestlers not in their gymnasia, but tossing in the fiery billows." Unquote. And jumping forward to 5 centuries after Aquinas, American Great Awakening leader Jonathan Edwards, he of Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God fame, delivered a 1739 sermon entitled The Eternity of Hell Torments, with the following affirmation. Quote, "The sight of hell torments will exalt the happiness of the saints forever." Unquote. And, quote, "Can the believing husband in heaven be happy with his unbelieving wife in hell? Can the believing father in heaven be happy with his unbelieving children in hell? Can the loving wife be happy in heaven with her unbelieving husband in hell? I tell you, yea, such will be their sense of justice that it will increase rather than decrease their bliss." Unquote. That many advocates of altruistic ethics are motivated explicitly by the desire to destroy is not only the stuff of exaggeration or fiction. To summarize, thus far, it is clear that Rand has learned from Nietzsche's critique of altruism and is in agreement with its general thrust. Rand's break with Nietzsche's critique. If we follow the Nietzschean interpretation, then the great battle in history is the struggle between the strong and the weak. Nietzsche's position is based on seeing the weak and the strong as essentially in a zero-sum situation from which there is no escape. The strong are objectively a threat to the weak, so the weak must treat them as such. The weak are necessarily consumed with envy and resentment of the strong, so their best satisfaction can only come from pulling the strong down. The Nietzschean thesis can then be put apparently paradoxically. Altruism is the egoism of the weak. It is their best weapon in the ongoing battle for survival against the strong. Slave morality, Nietzsche writes in Genealogy of Morals, is, quote, "the prudence of the lowest order," unquote. To switch to Rand's language, the Nietzschean thesis is that the great battle is the battle between the Gail Winans of the world and the Ellsworth Tuies of the world. Both Winand and Tuie seek power, but by different means. The Winans use traditional selfishness's tools of money and physical prowess, while the Tuies use altruism's psychological tools of guilt and pity. The great breakthrough of the Fountainhead is to show that dichotomy to be a false alternative. Here Rand both strongly diverges from Nietzsche and is innovative in ethics. Altruism, she argues, is not the egoism of the weak. Altruism is destructive to both weak and strong. Howard Roark's strategy is neither to side with the Winans against the Tuies nor to side with the Tuies against the Winans. Roark's strategy is independent, creative production and trade with those who recognize his value as an independent creator and producer. Perhaps not everyone can be as creative and productive as a Roark. For Rand, the fact of inequalities of abilities does not change the moral facts involved. The egoism of the weak, in contrast to Nietzsche's thesis, is to respect and admire the strong, to promote their freedom, and to be aware of the overflow benefits to come to them from the strong. The average person may not be able to design and build as well as Rourke can, yet thousands of average people can, with productive effort, earn the money in order to live in one of Rourke's buildings. And thousands more get the aesthetic benefit of seeing Rourke's buildings, even if they do not get to live in them. In Atlas Shrugged, Rand uses the example of a janitor who makes a decent living working in a factory. The janitor did not create a factory, including its ability to pay his salary. The janitor adds value to the enterprise and so earns his pay. He is a value to the factory's creators. At the same time, the factory's creators have added value to his life, the opportunity to make a living at that job. The abilities and skill sets differ, and there is a harmony of values that enables win-win trade. That, Rand argues, is the fundamental truth about the relationship between stronger and weaker. Properly conceived, it can and should be mutually beneficial. Rand puts it this way in Galt's speech, quote, "In proportion to the mental energy he spent, the man who creates a new invention receives but a small percentage of his value in terms of material payment, no matter what fortune he makes, no matter what millions he earns. But the man who works as a janitor in the factory, producing that invention, receives an enormous payment in proportion to the mental effort that his job requires of him. And the same is true of all men between, on all levels of ambition and ability. The man at the top of the intellectual pyramid contributes the most of all to those below him, but gets nothing except his material payment, receiving no intellectual bonus from others who add the value of his time. The man at the bottom, who, left to himself, would starve in his hopeless ineptitude, contributes nothing to those above him, but he receives the bonus of all their brains. Such is the nature of the, quote, competition, unquote, between the strong and the weak of the intellect. Such is the pattern of, quote, exploitation, unquote, for which you have damned the strong, unquote. The janitor who hates his boss on principle, or who sees the factory's creators as his enemies, has made an error, a self-destructive misjudgment about his self-interest. In Atlas Shrugged, for example, Dagny Taggart is not the enemy of Eddie Willers, nor is Eddie Willers the enemy of Pop Harper, the chief clerk, nor is Pop Harper the enemy of an anonymous line worker far below in the underground terminal. Nor are any of us the enemies of the geniuses who create in music, business, technology, art, athletics, or philosophy. The idea that those of us who have lesser abilities in any of those areas should want to control or destroy those who are superior is stupidly self-destructive to the highest degree. Yet Nietzsche's commitment to a fundamental adversarial zero-sum position does commit him to the view that altruism is to the self-interest of the weaker. It yields the implication that if one has less musical talent, then one's self-interest is that the Beethovens and Rachmaninoffs be destroyed, recalling the fictional portrayal of Antonio Salieri in Peter Schaffer and Milos Forman's Amadeus, that if one has less athletic talent, that the Babe Ruths and Michael Jordans be handicapped, recalling the pathetically real-life example of Tonya Harding and Nancy Kerrigan, that if one is a so-so businessman, that the John D. Rockefellers and Bill Gateses be bridled, recalling the language invoked in most antitrust debates about the dangers of unbridled competition. This is a striking and fundamental difference between Nietzsche's and Rand's interpretations of altruism. Rand also believes that the egoism of the less talented is to respect themselves for their potential and for their committing to achieving it. Not everyone can be a Michael Jordan, but the measure of a good life is not primarily comparative. It is a matter of making one's own independent choices, forming one's own character and interests, making one's own way in the world in whatever way suits one best and to whatever degree one's energies and abilities allow. It is not the scale of one's abilities that is primarily morally significant. It is the fact that one's abilities are one's own abilities and that one has committed to using them to achieve one's own life. In that respect, being a moral giant is within the reach of any of us. Altruism, by contrast, encourages the less talented to disrespect themselves, to make comparative judgments as fundamental to their self-worth, and to see themselves as relatively helpless or as victims, and to plot and act against the more talented. In part one of this essay, we have concentrated on the negative, that is, Nietzsche's and Rand's critiques of altruism. Now we will turn to their positive programs, that is, what they take a proper egoism to entail.